Welcome, everybody. Episode 37 of Nerds United, Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, jitterymonkey.com, available iTunes, Stitcher. You know the routine. Make sure you head on over there and
subscribe.
That's right. Vince from Vince Does Voices, youtube.com/mycomedy, M-I-K-omedy. And my old buddy, Rob, who, he's my voice guy, and we need to get him on the show very soon. So be listening for that. Just a tremendous guy with tons of great stories. But anyway, this episode, episode 37, features another interview with a Nebraska Cornhusker connection, another contact that I made partially because I'm a Nebraska Cornhusker fan and partially because I like comics, just like Van Jensen. You got to go all the way back to episode one, almost 2 years ago, to hear that story. But this time we'll be talking with an artist who has met Mr. Van Jensen, but he is a talented, heck of a talented artist in his own right, Colorado-based Jay Peter Onitz. We'll be visiting with Jay about Magicians Must Die, what it is and why you might not have heard of it, but it's pretty cool. A stellar little idea, and we're going to learn more about the concept as well as his contributions and some of the other work. We'll get his origin story, as we tend to do with first-timers here on Nerds United, and we'll find out all that he's been up to. And it's going to be a good time. Great conversation is on the way with Jay Peter Onitz.
Comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Welcome, everybody. Nerds United, episode 37. Greg Mahochko here, and thank you for tuning in wherever you may be. Leave your feedback. Leave a location. Hey, we're on Stitcher and iTunes. You can always leave a comment, jitterymonkey.com, or on the Facebook page, be it the Jittery Monkey Facebook page or Nerds United. We're on Twitter as well, so thank you all for the support and for tuning in and for hitting that subscribe button. In episode 37, we have a similar story as we had in episode 1. If you remember episode 1, Van Jensen, and the catalyst to beginning the Nerds United journey, if you will, a link was sent to me via Twitter, and it was to a former UNL grad, a Cornhusker fan, if you will, who was writing comics. And at the time, he was just starting to write for Green Lantern Corps. His name, of course, was Van Jensen. He's a Nebraska native. Now, while we're talking to what many would call a native Coloradan, I don't know the proper term, but there's a similar connection there because I'm on Facebook, and I rarely, but sometimes, contribute to a Cornhusker column site, whatever you want to call it, cornnation.com. Very appreciative of the tolerance that they have for me for keeping me involved in all of the email chains, even though I really don't contribute much. But one of the contributors, his name is Ty, and I remember, you know, I've met Ty. We've shared meal, we've broken bread and shared beverages together in a previous trip that I had to Lincoln, Nebraska, and so we've been friends for a while, and I saw him post something on Facebook about how proud he was of his brother, and his brother was going to be at the Denver Comic-Con once again, and I said, wait a minute, type, your brother draws comics, type, and he said, well, you know, something, I was feigning offense that he didn't tell me, you know, like he's supposed to. He said, oh, I'm sorry. I was just proud of my brother. So with all that being said, episode 37 is Ty's brother. Welcome to the show, Mr. Jay Peter Onitz. Jay, how is that?
Yes.
Is that an appropriate build-up, a lead-in?
I think that might talk me up a little bit more than it should have, but I'm good with that. I'm okay with that. That feels good.
I feel like perhaps I undersold. I should have hyped more.
Well, you can keep going. I have an ego that you can feed as much as you would like there, sir.
In this corner, With the magic hands of a well-trained artiste.
Woohoo! That's good.
From Denver, Colorado, or?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Lafayette, which is just northwest of Denver. And I think Coloradan, not the Coloradoan.
Oh.
Killio.
Killio. Yeah. If you kill all the O's in Colorado, you're going to have a very confused word.
Clarad.
Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. This is fantastic. I'm glad we got connected finally. We got hooked up, and let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics. First, before we go any further, and we'll highlight this again at the end of the show, I mentioned the Denver Comic Con, but that's not the only place you'll be traveling to in this con season, correct?
That is the place that I will have a table at so far. I am traveling to Emerald City. I'll be walking around as an attendee at the end of the month. And then hopefully I'll get back to either New York or Heroes Con this year, but probably more than likely New York Comic Con.
And New York, I understand, it drew as many, if not more, people as San Diego last year. I mean, it's really boomed up.
It has surpassed San Diego as the largest comic book convention in the U.S.
But, I mean, to that point, I think size or at least size of admission, I think you're still getting more, I don't know, I don't want to say more bang for your buck, but there still seems like there's more to do, perhaps. I've only been to one con, and I'll be going there again in a few weeks, or next month anyway, the Cape Comic-Con, Cape Girardeau, Missouri. But, you know, when you get to those bigger ones, New York is New York. I mean, it is the shining pinnacle of human achievement, you know, depending on whose opinion you take. Is there more to see at New York than at San Diego? It still seems like San Diego is the holy grail of Comic-Cons.
I think for comic-based entertainment, I completely agree with you. It is definitely the holy grail of Comic-Cons out there in San Diego. But New York did expand to a week this year, and they kind of engulfed all of Manhattan. So they had a whole bunch going on last year, which apparently was fantastic. I didn't get an opportunity to see it, but I heard a lot of people say a lot of good things, and that's really what helped push attendance up.
And I mean, there are a lot more comic heroes who are based in New York than San Diego. So it's a lot higher likelihood that you'll run into the Avengers or Fantastic Four or Spider-Man in New York than you will in San Diego.
I mean, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm just glad to know that they finally got everything cleaned up after that Chitauri mess from a few years back up in New York City.
Well, you know, I guess it took a little while, but since they did finally get that taken care of, I didn't see any issues when I was up there. So, but I guess they've got, Ultron coming around this summer, and I guess he's put out a few threats that something may be happening around May. So we'll see if they can get that taken care of by the time New York comes around again this year.
Regardless of the amount of collateral damage that Ultron may or may not cause, it will be a worldwide phenomenon. I'm as pumped as anybody for Age of Ultron.
Oh, it's going to be so good. It's going to be so, so good.
I was catching just a few words from one of the many nerd-related podcasts that I listen to. This happened to be Fat Man on Batman, and they were talking about Age of Ultron and how it's just... Just based on that newest trailer that came out about a week ago or so, how it appears to be cinematic perfection, and something about Joss Whedon or Marvel, they just seem to be able to do no wrong.
You know, Joss Whedon impressed me immensely with the last one. I think the best shot and most innovative shot that I saw in the last Avengers was where the car gets blown up and he goes inside the car and flips with the car, so you see the environment moving, but the car doesn't. I was just blown away by that shot. I thought that was absolutely amazing. So I became a huge believer in Joss Whedon at that point, you know, had I not already been because of Firefly and Buffy and, you know, all those other things.
Some of those things, I mean, you go to Buffy, and that was, of course, in the 90s. That's a show that a lot of people grew up with. But what Marvel Studios is doing now, and I promise listeners, we're going to hear Jay's origin story. I wasn't BSing you at the beginning, but we fall into this, you know, comic book movie adaptation conversation. We can go on forever. But what Marvel Studios is doing, when they take a not even tertiary tier, not even a three-tier, you know, group, but what they did with Guardians of the Galaxy and made that, you know, the blockbuster sensation that it was. And before that movie came out, how many even casual comic book fans knew who the Guardians of the Galaxy were? What Marvel's doing is unsurpassed, I think.
Oh, I think they scored a complete hit with Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, I've been a Guardians of the Galaxy reader since I started reading comics. What really got me into comics was Jim Starlin and his Marvel Cosmic Universe. So those are my peeps, man. Those Guardians are them my boys and my ladies, you know what I mean? yeah, what they did with that, probably the second or third best Marvel movie that the Marvel Studios camp has done. I mean, it's top tier, absolute top tier.
And as a longtime Guardians of the Galaxy fan or reader, did you feel like, I mean, obviously it sounds like, you know, they not only hit the financial success and the windfalls, but did they treat the characters the way that you would have wanted them treated?
I think they did a fantastic job. The only one that I was a little, excuse me, disappointed by was Gamora. She was not the extremely capable assassin that she talks about being and that they portray her as in the comics, but you can't make her invincible in the movies. So I understand. Definitely understand.
It took me back, the Thanos-Nebula connection took me back to the Super Nintendo days. I had a game that I wore out, and it was Marvel Heroes versus, you know, I think it was the Infinity Gems games.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact title of it, but you could play as Hulk or Iron Man or Captain America, Spider-Man or Wolverine, and you had to go collect the Infinity Stones, and then you had a boss battle with Nebula before facing off with Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember the game?
I do. I don't remember the title of it, but I do remember it.
That was my, I mean, that's really, aside from that, you know, of course, the end of the Avengers and then going into Guardians of the Galaxy, that's really my only exposure to the Marvel Cosmic Universe. And I've been reading a little bit more. I enjoyed Original Sin last year, and mm-hmm. they kind of, you know, spread it out. Before we jump off of this topic, do you have any guesses as to who you think Star-Lord's father is in this Guardians of the Galaxy take?
Oh Lord, I couldn't even tell you.
No,
no, he's, you know, they've done so many potential fathers and parents. I don't think they're going to go Jason Quill. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they have to go more cosmic than that. It could be Adam Warlock because they have to introduce him. If they don't introduce Adam Warlock, I'm going to be completely disappointed in every single Marvel movie. Let's just throw that out right now. But I don't know. I don't know where they're going to go with it.
Very interesting take on that. And there was even that that notion that the cocoon-like figure in the collection was an incarnation of Adam Warlock.
Yeah.
Any? Do you lend any credence to that, or in that
Absolutely.
Easter egg?
Absolutely. Well, he's a character that is so integral into the Infinity War and the Infinity Gauntlet and those series that if they don't bring him in at some point, they're not going to do him any justice. And with the third tier movies coming, you do have a Captain Marvel, which is going to expand the cosmic universe even further. You've got your Doctor Strange. You're leading right up to what the Infinity Gauntlet did and the Infinity War did and all those great comics by Jim Starlin from the 80s and 90s, that if you don't introduce the main hero and main character of those movies, I just don't know what you're doing.
Would the Infinity Gauntlet movies or Infinity War, you know, it was part one and two,
mm-hmm.
without Adam Warlock be the same as having Captain America Civil War without Spider-Man?
Because, that's a good question.
Because I look at Spider-Man as an integral part of the Civil War, you know, comic storyline.
Yeah, and he was a big part of it, but I don't know if Spider-Man played as necessary of a role as Adam Warlock does in the Infinity Gauntlet stuff, because Adam Warlock really is the catalyst that gets the Avengers to space. Spider-Man plays a little bit less of a role in Civil War, if you ask me, even though I know he comes out as Spider-Man and then he's the Iron Spider and then he switches sides. And, you know, there's a lot that he does in that, but really that is Iron Man versus Captain America, whereas the Infinity Gauntlet really is Adam Warlock versus Thanos. So if you took Captain America out of Captain America Civil War, then that would be the same as taking Adam Warlock out of the Infinity War movies.
Fair enough. I like that. That's probably as clean a diagnosis as we're going to find. So you mentioned Guardians of the Galaxy being what you were reading when you first got into comics. So how old were you? What was the year? What was the time like? Were you listening to Blue Suede?
No, I was not listening to Blue Suede. Let's see.
Because now I think that song is synonymous for whatever reason with Guardians of the Galaxy. Kudos to Marvel.
Oh, yeah. I went out and got Awesome Mix as soon as it came out, and I'm really tempted to go get it on cassette, but I don't know how I'd play it. It's kind of like the VHS tapes I have sitting on my shelf. They're not doing anything, just collecting dust.
Right.
So, my very first exposure to comics was, 1989. And the very first comic I picked up was Jim Lee and Chris Claremont's X-Men number one.
That was the
very first book.
Now, that was if I'm remembering correctly, that's probably the series that I have or the issue that I have, you know, splashed out with all the variants on as the cover photo, if you will, on the Facebook page.
That would be the one, I believe.
And do you remember which cover that you had at the time or that you were reading?
I went and I got, I think it was the Magneto cover.
Aha, the last picture of, you know, the... I think that I like variant covers, but I think that if they would have... I don't know, because it's been so long since I've even read that. I got that box last summer that had those in it. But those were all variants of number one.
Yes. Well, and you know, they had the four covers, and then they had all of them together in a gatefold cover. Right. And I definitely have the gatefold cover still in package, unopened. And I have the Colossus Rogue Gambit cover, and I've got the Magneto cover. And I don't think I have the Wolverine Cyclops. I think it's the only one I don't have.
But would it not have made more? And I know that they, you know, if there's one thing that we've seen is that they like to milk, you know, the comic book consumers for as much as they can to their credit, and it oftentimes works. But would it have not made more sense to have spread, you know, those covers out over, you know, the four books that it took to encompass that one cover, or am I thinking too consumer friendly?
I think you're thinking too consumer-friendly.
It's been my bane forever.
I mean, you got to think that this may have been the start of the image influx of variant covers where, like, Fathom by Michael Turner, for example, on the first issue had 9 alternate covers, I think, and issue 0, which released with Wizard and then re-released with the blue foil text and then re-released with the gold foil text and then re-released with the white foil. I mean, that may have been started by Jim Lee and Chris Claremont's X-Men number one, which came with 5 covers. And come on.
Yeah.
You have to think that if there was one person out there who would buy all of them, it was me, and I was.
You were not alone.
I'm sure.
I acquired the box, and people who, you know, listeners who remember this story from last spring, last summertime, a friend of mine passed away unexpectedly, and much to everybody's shock and surprise. And as his parents were going through his stuff, and you know, he's my age, 32, they came across a box of comics. They knew what I'd been doing, and they said, "Here you go. You can hold on to it. You can you know, do whatever you want with it. And just going through those and bagging and boarding, I said, are you kidding me? He's got the complete picture right there. Yeah, that's staying in the collection forever. I don't care what happens.
There you go. Well, I was looking through my Fathom comics probably about a year ago, and of the 14 issues that Michael Turner did, I think I have 45 different issues because of the variant covers.
And again, I think maybe now you being on the artist side of it, you like as many variants as possible because from the business standpoint, doesn't that have to, you know, help your numbers at the end of the month?
Oh yeah. Yeah, if you get them, you know, multiple variants and you can sell out the entire run at distribution, that's a good thing. It's a very, very good thing. So from the artistic side, I love it. From the consumer side, I hate it.
Okay, so at least we have some common ground there.
Oh, man. The first alternate cover that I bought in years was, I had to buy two, was Arkham Manor, number one. I had to buy the one by Sean Crystal, because Sean Crystal, who is an amazing artist, was my program coordinator at SCAD when I was getting my master's degree. And there was an alternate cover by Eric Canetti. And if you don't know Eric Canetti or his artwork, you have to know Eric Canetti. He is amazing. So I had to buy his as well. His first alternate cover that I had bought in addition to the main cover in probably 10 years.
What just... Because you had that personal connection to the artist, I mean, did you find that was, you know, kind of a catalyst to, you know, wanting to support, you know, both? Or, I mean, what's the driving force for you? You know, let's say there's no, you know, personal attachment. You know, you didn't know this individual. Are you just, you know, you're in your shop. You're like, oh, man, that's a sweet cover. I've got to have that.
I don't do that too often, because if it's really a sweet, sweet cover and I really need to get it, or I really want to get the image, we have this beautiful thing called the internet, which
what is the internet? Tell me.
Okay, so it connects computers from one place to another across the world. So if you haven't got on this yet, you might want to. You can actually give internet radio to the world through this beautiful thing. So you might want to think about it.
Tell me more about this internet radio. What? I'm not familiar.
Well, you might want to get on that, because otherwise what we're doing right now might be a little pointless.
Fair enough.
Anyway, no, so it's definitely the personal connection. I am getting to be good friends with a lot of artists in the industry and a lot of people who are doing amazing work right now, and I will support them fully. So if they do a book, I pick it up, even if it's mediocre art, if it's mediocre story, I will pick it up, because I just want to support the people who have been so good to me and have given me tips and advice across the years. So I definitely pick up their books. And when I see an alternate cover by a friend, I will usually go grab it just to help support them.
Very similar boat to what I'm in from the podcasting side. You know, I had not heard of Van Jensen before I spoke with him that first time. I mean, and since then I've bought Pinocchio Vampire Slayer,
which is amazing.
Oh, it's so good. And if you haven't, you know, listeners, we've talked about it before, and I can't wait to visit. Van and I have this running thing. The first time we talked was in June of 2013. We talked again June of last year. We're kind of making it June as our month to hang out and have a little chat for the listeners. But there's so much more of his that I want to, you know, just read and enjoy. I've only read the first book of Pinocchio, and I know there's a lot more to get into. But it was because of him that I'm reading The Flash. His contribution and his writing on that, just and he's certainly not the only one. I had an author on last month. Listeners will know Ross Cavins, and I've, you know, supported his Kickstarter. I supported Kickstarters of other previous guests, and you know, bought their works and things like that. Do you watch Comic Book Men on AMC?
I don't, unfortunately. I've seen a couple episodes, but I don't get a chance to watch it on a regular basis.
This past week, which if you're listening to this, you know, sometime, it, you know, shortly after I posted, but it was the episode with DMX, of all people, or not DMX, DMC. I don't know why. Yep. I got DMX, but a DMC, which is slightly different from DMX. Yep. But DMC and, you know, Daryl McDaniels, and I shot him a tweet, you know, saying, what's the proper channels I've got to go through to have you? Because, you know, now he's, you know, creating comic books. I said, I'd like to have you on the show. And not only did they respond, which I wasn't expecting, they followed me and they said, DM your contact info and we'll try to make it happen. And so right after that, I contacted my local comic book shop and said, can you order me up a couple DMCs? I have no problem supporting, you know, the people who've taken time, invested some time to visit with me. Certainly, I'm so excited to visit with you about Magicians Must Die and learn more about that and support that. My wife doesn't always agree with it, but that's why I have this slush fund that I call it. I like to, you know, throw a few dollars, you know, that she doesn't always know about. That being said, let's talk more. Now, it was Jim Lee, Chris Claremont. Yep. X-Men number one, but yep. As you said, you've always been, you know, you were reading the Jim Starlin, you know, Marvel cosmic stuff. I'm sensing a lot of, I don't know, maybe Marvel influence, but did you ever get into, or when did you start reading some of the DC stuff? I know you mentioned Arkham Manor.
It was rare for me to pick up DC. Like, I'm a huge Batman fan, but there was so much Batman stuff that I didn't know really where to go. I picked up Legends of the Dark Knight number one, which came out in like 92, 93, somewhere around there. And that was a lot of origin, and that got me hooked on Batman. 1989's Batman movie got me hooked on Batman, but I never got into the comics. I always thought they were a little too, I guess, cliched. They didn't have the flawed hero like Marvel did. It was a little less human than Marvel was. So I read a lot of Marvel, and this is really funny me saying that considering I did the cosmic stuff, which was the more out of this world stuff. But for some reason, those characters just resonated with me better. So I read a lot of Marvel. I read a lot of Image when Image picked up. I think I have every single Image number one when it came out. I know I've got the Wildcats stuff. I know I've got Youngblood. I know I've got Shadowhawk, Savage Dragon, Pit. I picked up, I think, all of those because that's what I was reading. And when those artists jump shipped, I went with them. And then I think DC really came around a lot more recently, with Wildstorm picking up and Wildcats 3.0. I picked up a lot of that when Travis Charest was doing it. And, Watchmen was a big one for me and got into some more DC side and followed Jim Lee when he went to DC. So that really got me into it with Batman Hush and Superman for Tomorrow. And so it was really me following artists more than it was me following stories.
And in my conversations with, you know, some of the people that I've had on, they will, you know, they'll forgive art that they don't, you know, I don't want to say appreciate or care for, but you know, they'll forgive the art if they're really into the story. And then you get, you know, other individuals who are like, I'll follow an artist because I like their style. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the names, I mean, you've mentioned Jim Lee, Greg Capullo is another one. I'm sure if you've been reading any of the new 52 Batman, you know, stuff like that, been able to see kind of a darker gritty. I'll say this, one of my favorite artists and kind of get your take on him, is Alex Ross and his style, that painted style.
Alex Ross is a fantastic illustrator. I think his painting and his illustration is amazing. I think when you get that really painted style, you get really stiff. And I think his comics do end up very stiff. There's not a lot of energy to them. Kingdom Come by he and Mark Waid was amazing, just absolutely amazing. And when he did Marvel's, I mean, it was definitely innovative for the time, but it doesn't have the energy and flow that I think comics should have.
Is this something, is that style, does that take a lot longer to, you know, put together an issue than, I don't want to say more traditional, but you know, than the stuff that you're more used to seeing on the comic page?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I'm sure the whole paint style takes way too long. A friend of mine, Andrew Robinson, just finished the fifth Beetle. Well, it didn't just finish, but did all the painted work inside the fifth Beetle. And if you want to see a good mix of cartoony and painted, he does a really, really good job of bringing and keeping the energy in his paints. But it took him 4.5 years to complete that graphic novel. So I think it's something like 120 or 140 page graphic novel. And if you haven't read it, it's Vivek Tiwari and Andrew Robinson. The book is spectacular, absolutely spectacular book. And it won an Eisner, I think two Eisners actually last year for best graphic novel and best, painted comic work.
How old were you, Jay, when you came across, stumbled across, found comics?
I was 7.
So that's, you know, let me see, you're early 30s then?
Yep, early 30s. So it was actually 25 years ago this year.
Mm-hmm. Wow, apparently you and I are the same age-ish. I remember, you know, and people who've listened to the show, you know, they know my first comics were hand-me-downs, I think, from my uncle. And they were some of those, you know, classic Lee and Ditko Marvel titles. I mean, I had some Spider-Man, had some Fantastic Four. There was an old Thor. I mean, there were some, like, some of the, who was it, Shang-Chi, you know, the Master of Kung Fu.
Yeah.
Had one of those in there. And some of the, like, the Army, you know, World War II type of, you know, stories. Those were the first ones for me until I started finding them, you know, on my own, going to the grocery store. There's a spinner rack, you know, walking, you know, gas station or mall, something like that. How did you start to, you know, when you finally took an interest, where were you finding them?
My first comics were from a friend of mine in class, like third grade, I think. He would bring something new on almost a weekly basis. And when I started going to find them myself, it was Time Warp Comics in Boulder. And Time Warp Comics has been around for, I think, 30 years. So last year was their 30th anniversary. But they are probably, if not the premier, one of the premier comic book stores in the state of Colorado. And they were up for Retailer of the Year last year, but they have an amazing store, and I would just walk through and see cool art and pick it up. I didn't even really follow stories until I think Marvel did the 2099 stuff. Then I picked up all the 2099, but I would just pick up random stuff here and there until that point. So Time Warp was my, they were my crack into comics.
And I imagine that as a kid, you know, you're not going to sit there probably and flip through and read the first couple pages. You know, now you can go on Amazon, you know, if you don't have a, you know, hometown store, or you're a distant, you know, or you want something more immediate, you can, you know, there have been times where I've been sitting in my office, or when I was in radio, I'd sit in the studio and I'd, you know, they have that free offering and you can read the first few pages and, you know, kind of tell if you're going to like the story or not. But as a kid, I imagine it's going to be the art, you know, that pops out at you, that's going to, you know, draw you in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That cover art really makes you go.
Which is why, you know, the X-Men's, you know, all that stuff was so attractive to the younger eyes. And I'm not saying that to be weird or anything, but you understand where I'm coming from.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Beautiful women, beautiful men.
I have definitely. Since you mentioned the Marvel 2099, I have to ask you, because in my youth, I had a couple of the X-Men 2099 issues, and it didn't seem like it had a real long run. But I was wondering if you ever read any of, you know, the futuristic take on the X-Men, and if so, what you thought about it?
Oh, I thought it was great. Ron Lim was the artist on the series, at least to start. And I really, really liked Ron Lim's art. And I was introduced to Ron Lim by the Infinity Gauntlet series. He took over for George Perez when Perez couldn't finish it. I liked it. I thought it was really, really good. Not the most amazing characters ever, not the most amazing story ever. And they went some really strange directions with it. But what I did like about it is it wasn't really a traditional X-Men story where you have the team get together and go fight the bad guy. There was a lot of infighting in it, which was great. So the team actually ended up doing a lot of fighting between each other, and their leader turned evil, and this character died in like the third issue, and she was one of the more interesting characters. So they did a lot of good stuff to really make it different.
One of the things that I remember from reading, and I've got those books, I'm sure, somewhere, you know, at the house now, but I do remember, like you said, the group infighting. I mean, the X-Men of today, if you will, the most infighting you see, I think, is at least the most people are most familiar with is the Wolverine, Cyclops, Jean Grey love triangle stuff. But this was, yep. I mean, this stuff in the X-Men 2099 was, you know, they're fighting over what, leadership and, yep. and just all kinds of, you know, who's doing what and who's in charge of what. And just a lot of resentment, a lot of bitterness. Like they really didn't want to be a team.
Yeah. Yeah. They were kind of forced together because of their capabilities and their powers, and they just couldn't figure it out. So I thought that was really cool.
At what point, Jay, did you start picking up the pencil and working on, you know, some of your own art, some of your own style? Is it something that you did from a very early age and you just evolved that style, or did you kind of wait until you had a little bit more training, or have you always been, you know, I don't want to say doodling it as in, you know, as a slap in the face or anything like that, but have you always been kind of, you know, like, yeah, I've got 10 minutes, I'm going to see what I can create type of thing?
Oh, it wasn't just I have 10 minutes. It was I'm taking notes in class on one side of my notebook and drawing on the other page. I think when I was 7, when I first picked up X-Men, my buddy and I that were reading it really tried to recreate the heroes and didn't do so well. But we tried to recreate the heroes and we tried to design our own and make our own characters. And we had, I think by the time we were out of elementary school at 12, we had a canon of something like 90 or 95 characters that we had developed backstories for and never went anywhere with any of them, of course. But we just drew and drew and drew and drew and drew. So when I got to middle school and high school, I was on the medical doctor path, taking as much math and science as I could, because that's what you needed to do to be a doctor. And until my sophomore year, when the Western admissions rep from the Savannah College of Art and Design came to my photography class and showed us the video, and there was a major for sequential art, which was comic books. And I said, well, screw that doctor thing. I'm going to go get a degree in comic books.
And your parents wept openly.
Oh, no. They thought it was fantastic. They said, well, you've been drawing since you were little, and you've been drawing forever and ever and ever. And so, absolutely, if that's what you want to do, let's go visit. So we did, and fell in love with Savannah, fell in love with the school, and since then it's just been this constant evolution of art and drawing and character and storytelling, and going back for my master's degree really solidified, I think, what I want to do with my art and where I want to go with it and who I need to find as influences. But it's 25 years of time at the table and getting things down and put together and figured out, and it's finally starting to come together.
Quick anecdote, and then I want to ask you about your drawing style. But a couple years back, I sat down with a sketch pad and Blackest Night number 2. And as we all know, everybody who's been listening, it was Blackest Night 0 on Free Comic Book Day that got me back into comics. But Blackest Night number 2 has Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, with his, you know, ring aglow, and you see Black Hand in there, and all these brought back to life, you know, Black Lantern-esque, you know, villains. And I just sat down, I tried to freehand sketch Hal Jordan as the Green Lantern there, and I took a picture of it, put it online, and I got, you know, one response was, hey, nice job for your first time ever, and then somebody says, because of the shading on Hal Jordan's face, you know, it kind of looked like a thin mustache, and they said, when did Hal Jordan become Mexican, type of thing. So I said, I took the picture down and I've yet to pick it up again. That and I'm not blaming them, it was an atrocious drawing, and you know, but I wasn't it wasn't that I was so discouraged. It was like, you know, I've got talents, you know, that lie beyond pencil and paper. So I'll leave that to the talented individuals like yourself, Jay. And
thank you.
That brings me to the question I kind of foreshadowed there is, how would you define, describe, or can you even define or describe your drawing style?
Is very, very high contrast. I take a lot of influence from guys like Frank Miller and Eduardo Risso, Edvin Bukovic, who didn't do much when he was alive, but he did the first Human Target miniseries for DC and Vertigo when it was around. So I've been strongly influenced by them. Really stark blacks, really deep blacks, really thin line. I started to put a bit more feathering into my work, very like Mignola style, very simple, very small feathers. But I tend to draw more towards those really stark, high contrast, solid use of dark shape and black space artists.
You mentioned one of the names you mentioned there was Mike Mignola, of course, the creator of Hellboy, which just celebrated 20 years, I believe.
Yes, sir.
And not only do I enjoy the books, and really, if you haven't out there, you know, listening, if you're wondering just something a little different, you know, it's not the capes and cowls or domino masks, pick up a Hellboy, because you've got some nice writing, some nice art in there. And, you know, of course, it was popular enough to make not one but two movies. And I thought maybe I heard that there might be a third on the way, but I cannot confirm that. But what I like about it is, you know, Mike Mignola does that all really himself. I mean, it's a completely, completely creator-owned piece, and to his credit, he's been able to kind of keep—I don't want to say keep, you know, the big two away from it, but able to maintain that control and put out a product that, even though he's not maybe not putting out an issue every month, he's putting out something that he likes, that he approves of, and that, you know, he doesn't have to take input from anybody else.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and he owns that entire world, which is fantastic. The BRP stuff, the Hellboy work, the Abe Sapien, everything is Mike Mignola, and it is just spectacular.
Like I said, I'm a fan. I've got a Seed of Destruction at the house, and one or two other trade paperbacks. Like I said, if you're looking for something new, something different, if you just want to start reading something that maybe you haven't read before, go check out the Hellboy stuff, the BPRD, and just kind of enjoy a short little trip, a jaunt, if you will, into the mind of Mike Mignola. Looking at your art, I mean, and let's jump into it. By golly, we're 41 minutes in, and we have really only touched the surface. Not even touched the surface. We've only mentioned Magicians Must Die. So let's spend some time talking about that, because you just finished issue number 4. And,
yes.
And before we get to that, and folks, you can check out the video on jitterymonkey.com along with the post where you might find this article. It's posted right there on Facebook for your viewing pleasure. But the how to explain to me, first of all, what Magicians Must Die is.
Magicians Must Die is the world's first and world's only comic book on playing cards. It is on playing cards because the writer and producer, who is DeVoe von Schattenreich,
say that five times fast.
Yeah. A world-class card manipulator who started the extreme card manipulation art form. He has the world's fastest hands, or did in 2007, and has always wanted to do a comic book on playing cards, something different, something exciting, something he has an extreme passion for, is cards and comics. So when we met, he pitched the idea to me, and it took me about a week and a half to figure out how to get it laid out. And when we figured it out, I called him and said, I think I got it. Let's get it done. And he met with me. We looked at it, said, all right, let's do it. And we got issue number one done in about 6 weeks.
Explain the now, obviously, when you say you're putting a comic on a deck of cards, on a regular deck of playing cards, I watched the how does it work video that people can see. But essentially, now you're not making the comic on the playing face of the card, you know, like the four of diamonds. You're right. Using the back of it.
Yes. So don't play poker with it.
That's a good point. I didn't even think of that. I'm like, yeah, and holy cow.
Yeah, don't play cards with it.
What about Go Fish? I mean, could you play Go Fish with it?
You could probably do Go Fish with it, but
you could easily play War.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my mom is in a bridge club, and they have played bridge with it a couple times. So. But
I just think of like people sitting around playing Canasta or something.
I know, with this card deck, and I think that's just awesome. Yeah, she said, yeah, we're not paying that much attention to know what card backs are what, so right. we were good.
So for people who, you know, haven't yet or aren't going to, and shame on them, because it's a really cool explanation, how does you know, the story layout, how does it work?
The standard deck of playing cards comes with 56 cards, and that is the 52 cards you play with, the two jokers, and then there's always an add card and a rule card in a standard deck of bicycle playing cards. Now, this is printed by the United States Playing Card Company that does Bicycle and Aviator and B and the world's biggest card brands. They are the largest playing card company in the world, which is part of the reason we get to claim first and only, because they've never seen this before. But if you lay out basically in a brick seven cards across, and you just lay that out in eight rows, you get a full issue of a comic book laid out on the back of the cards.
I guess what I'm saying is, when I take my deck of cards out of my Magician's Must Die, you know, fresh from, you know, the seal, fresh from the store pack, I shuffle them up? I mean, I know there's a certain order, but is it like, okay, we're going to put, you know, the first page on the Ace of Diamonds and the second page on the Two of Diamonds, or is it really mixed up to where, you know, that you've got to follow a certain order, or is it more, am I putting too much thought into it, I guess?
You're putting a little too much thought into it.
Typical
when
me.
You open the deck, the very first card you pull out is the instruction card, and it tells you exactly how to lay it out. We wanted to make this as easy and as foolproof for readers as possible.
I appreciate that.
You pull the instruction card out, and it tells you exactly what to do. It says, place this card to your right, and then lay the next cards out in seven across. And then the next seven right below that, seven across. And then you just keep doing that until you're done. And when you're done laying the cards out and you don't have any left, you're going to have one space empty down in the bottom right corner. Well, on the instruction card, it says, flip this card over to complete the comic. So you take it, you flip it over, and boom, your comic is done. So your initial layout works like that. Now you've got a couple options at that point. You can pick it all right back up and backwards in order and get it for a new layout, or you take your instruction card, you put it to the side, you shuffle it all up, and then the instruction card tells you the order to put the cards back in. So you can get them back in order and go. Your other option is, there is an add card, which is the very last card, if you pull everything out of the box, has your key. So you can work it like a puzzle. And that's got the puzzle face on it, and you can look at that and do everything and put it all together like a puzzle, and then fill in the add card and the instruction card, and you're done. So
all well, I like, probably the best way to explain that is foolproof. There is no way for Greg Mahochko to mess this up.
The goal was, when we did the first one, we said, you know, there's a guy out there, Greg, who probably may not be the best in putting stuff together, so let's make it easy for him. So we did.
I failed Legos 101, if that's any indication.
Wow.
Like they said, make a stick with the Legos, and it ended up being a tree or something. I don't know. I'm just kidding. The without divulging too much, because I really want people to check this out, and you just put the wraps on issue 4, or, you know, the fourth deck. So without divulging too much, what's the storyline about?
The storyline is about a young card manipulator who gets captured by the evil magicians of the world, and he gets captured with his sister. And in the very first issue, we get to meet he and his sister in the magician's camp, and the magicians do not get along with the card masters. They definitely are at war with the card masters. And we see the main character, his name is D, manipulating cards. So the head magician, whose name is Dreyfus, puts him into an illusion in the second issue that he's supposed to know, because they're training to be magicians against their will. And after he gets put into the illusion, which he doesn't know how to get out of, he gets thrown over the edge of their camp down into this ravine and escapes. So in issue 2, he escapes. Issue 3 is kind of origin story of the world. And then issue 4 is the training. So we get to see how they, he and his sister train and get to become the master manipulators and illusionists that they are. And we'll see where it goes from there in issue 5.
And this story, these illusions were created by the master cardsman illusionist. I can't even pronounce his name right.
Let's call him DeVoe.
DeVoe, okay.
Illusions are actually created by Enrico de la Vega. Enrico de la Vega has done manipulations and illusions for some of the biggest names in magic at this moment, and his good friends with DeVoe, so we were able to use him as a consultant on these illusions. So we wanted to make them as real as possible and as capable as possible, so if a magician does pick this up, then he can kind of see how we are really making it an homage to magicians and their craft, as well as card manipulators and their craft, by making the illusions look as real as possible.
What I like about this, aside from the fact that it's never been seen before, is that it seems really entertaining. I mean, really fresh. You're taking 54, 56 cards, and you're putting a story out there. Now, my question to you as the artist is, how did you go about, you know, I mean, obviously you're not taking a deck of cards, at least I hope you're not taking a deck of cards and drawing on each one. What's the process like as far as getting these cards printed?
When I get the script from DeVoe, I will kind of look at the most important panels and figure out what needs to be more than a single card, because every card doesn't have a full image on it. I mean, take 2, 3, 4, 6, 12 cards to do a complete image. I mean, I'll decide what we really want to focus on in this issue, and I'll print out a small letter sized sheet of the 56 cards laid out in the 7x8, and lay out my paneling to figure out how I want the story to flow, and then I'll go from there and do a thumbnail sketch of the images that need to go within each panel, and then I'll print out a template, which is the dimensions of the card, and do all my drawing in inks at a little bit bigger than the size of the cards. Then I get to go back into my computer, lay it all back out into the 56 cards, color it at that size and at that with everything put together. And then the most painful part of it is, after I get the colors done, I get to break it back up into individual cards, because the USPC wants a layered file based on their die cut of the cards. So I have to break it back up into each individual playing card with the image that's going to be on that card put into a layered Adobe Illustrator file.
So that seems complicated.
Computer work, yeah, is a pain. But we get that done, the USPC, and they get it for print and proofs, and we approve. And usually within about 4 weeks, see this huge, huge stack of playing cards, which is amazing.
What now? I know we're running low on time here, but how long have you been working on the Magician's Must Die project from the beginning to, like I said, just within the last couple of weeks here, finishing up issue 4?
Our first issue released in November of 2012. So I started working on that one, I think, in July or August of 2012. The first issue sold out in a week and a half. So we sold 2,000 copies in a week and a half. So for Denver Comic Con 2013, we did a reprint of issue number 1. We did issue number 2. And then last year we had issue number 3 for Comic Con. And this year for Denver Comic Con, we'll have issue number 4.
Denver Comic Con, now what are the dates for that?
May 23rd through 25th. So we're hoping that everything gets printed on time. And right now we're online for that. But if there's a glitch in the printing process, we'll see.
Well, we certainly don't like glitches in the Matrix.
No.
So as far as getting them printed, now printing and packing, is that done by the USPC? Or
that is done entirely by the USPC.
Oh, that has to take a little bit of the load off, right?
I guess.
Okay.
I don't know. I haven't seen it any other way, so sure.
What before we go, and I certainly want to have you on the show again, because okay, we're just, you know, we're having a lot of fun talking, and I feel like we've just started to scratch the surface. You have an art-related day job that certainly we need to discuss, and that is the Art Institute of Colorado.
Yes, sir. I am a part-time professor at the Art Institute of Colorado here in the beautiful Mile High City that is Denver. So
what are you teaching at the Art Institute of Colorado, the AIC, if you will?
The AIC. I teach.
They probably don't call it the AIC, do they?
No.
All right. Leave it to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see if we can get that to catch on. But I teach the pre-production for animation and video games. So background design and storyboarding. And perspective and proportion, so making sure that you can get everything to look right and fit together correctly.
I'm already confused because that is not my world at all. But I can't wait to learn more about it, to catch up with you again in the near future. J. Peter Onitz, thank you so much, sir, for taking some time and visiting with me and talking some comics.
Absolutely. A couple quick things can I plug before we go?
No. Of course you can. Of course you can.
So, speaking of Time Warp earlier, Time Warp Comics has invited me to be there for free comic book day. So if you're in the Boulder, Denver area, the first Saturday in May, I will be at Time Warp Comics drawing, sketching, and I'll have some product available. And then there is a new comic book shop opening at 88th and Washington in Thornton, Colorado, that is called Mr. X Comics. That is the last weekend of May. I will be there. And if you are coming to Denver Comic Con, the badge art this year is mine. So come bring me your badge. I will sign it. I will have tons of posters, prints, and even some special metallic prints available at my table.
And if you want to see Nerds United get a stinking issue of Magicians Must Die, you got to help me get the likes of the follows up on Jay's Twitter account. We already missed the deadline, but if we can get within 2 weeks, I think 2 weeks is a fair amount of time, Jay.
I think that's fair.
If we can get you to 250 in 2 weeks.
250 in 2 weeks. Absolutely. You'll get a full set of Magicians Must Die. And for all you listeners out there, that's for you.
That is for you. Hey, there is no cost to you, the listener. This is 100% free, no purchase necessary. All you got to do is get on Twitter and hit that like button.
Yep, and we will sign them and send them your way.
Oh, see, that's a bonus. I wasn't even anticipating that. I never anticipate anything.
Sign, man. I am an autograph whore. I will sign whatever you bring to me.
Jay, it's been a lot of fun visiting with you. I know you got to go. It's Friday night, and believe me, we've all got better things to do. You've certainly got better things to do than talk to me. I don't blame you.
It is party time with myself and my four children. So
four children.
Yeah.
Uncle Ty needs to he needs to you know, get on the ball here. He's slacking.
Oh, he loves his nieces and nephew. Let's say that.
In Ty's defense, though, he is very busy snowmobiling, and having ownership in a local brewery in his town. So,
yes, sir.
That lucky jerk.
I know.
Jay, we'll catch up again in the near future, sir.
Greg, it was a great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. And Nerds United, let's go.
Let us go. And 250 followers in the next 2 weeks for Jay. You'll find his Twitter conveniently located, not just on the link, but we'll post it on Facebook. We'll share it on Twitter. All that fun stuff. So let's get him to 250, and let's get you a complete set. You, the listener, somebody's going to take home a complete set of Magicians Must Die.
Signed. Set signed.
From the autograph whore himself.
Awesome.
Jay, once again, thank you, sir. And that is Nerds United episode 37. We'll see you on down the road.
Thank you, Greg.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.